So let's see if this is the right location. Can you open it here? I have a tendency when I'm going to say the most important things, my voice goes like this. So if my voice fades, wave, echo, whatever needs to be done to get my attention. So thank you for inviting me to speak about the precepts. It's something which is, of course, dear to my heart and something which I don't understand that well. I do know, however, that it's a very central part of our tradition, and I value the chance to go into it and look at it some more. I think all of you know the kind of Soto Zen sayings, that things like Zen and the precepts are the same, or unity, or the precepts are the most important affair of our school. My favorite quote is from Eiken Roshi, who said, Zen without precepts is just a hobby. And also, I'm kind of grateful to be in this group because I feel it's part of the extended Buddhist community that I'm very much part of. And over the some 35 years that I've been involved in Buddhist practice, I really enjoyed appreciating how much the Buddhist community as a whole has matured. And you know, there's individual maturity or growth in the Dharma. There's also the growth of the community. And I think it kind of goes back and forth. And I feel that my own growth is very much dependent on the growth of the extended community. And part of this growth has been the exploration of ethics. And as the community is coming to a better, fuller understanding of it. So I'm going to talk about what I know about the highlights of the history of the Zen precepts. And I'd like to, in doing that, bring out a couple of maybe controversial points, some of the things that will surprise me if you haven't done this study before. And some of the things that I think Soto Zen teachers need to know about, if not somehow figure out some way to address. And then as I talk about history, I'll trace the history back to the very earliest periods of Buddhism through the Pali Canon. And then at the end of the talk, I'll come back to the Pali Canon to show something about how the understanding of ethics in the early tradition might be interesting or inform our understanding of the Zen precepts. I think every generation that addresses ethics has to address it anew because of the situation. And I think that our particular generation has some very unique, maybe every generation has something unique about the exploration of ethics. And I want to suggest four areas that makes it unique for us. One is, I think that we have modern kind of Buddhism has a much better survey, overview of the history of Buddhism than almost any other time in the history of Buddhism. And so that kind of overview lets us ask questions and look at things in very new ways. The second is, and as part of that, we have very good Buddhist scholarship. The whole field of Buddhist academic scholarship is a new field in the last 100, 150 years. And part of the advantage of academic Buddhism, study of Buddhism, is it frees us to liberate the movement and frees us from the propaganda of the sect as for itself. The self-propaganda kind of way in which the Soto Zen has presented itself. So hopefully it's a freeing thing. But we have to be free from the propaganda. We have to look at our own tradition in a new way as well. The third is that you know, we have our contemporary world. And I think many of us are interested in how Soto Zen, Zen, the precepts, apply to the global issues that the wider community is facing. Some of you have written about this even. And then the fourth thing is what loosely can be called a period of, I think, deep soul searching that has been going on for the last maybe 20, 25 years in Soto Zen around the ethics. And some of it you know, certainly exists here in the West around the individual ethics of individual teachers. And the Zen Center Ethics and Reconciliation Council was prompted or started by, or initiated by Reb Anderson and Mel Weitzman in response to some of the ethical difficulties in American Zen. But more kind of core than that is that, as hopefully you all know, in Soto Zen in Japan, starting in the late 1970s, 1980s and so forth, there's been a very, very deep soul searching about how Buddhist teachings and the Soto Zen teachings has been behind in reinforcing socialist discrimination in Japan. And when I was in Tsuyoji in Japan in 1984, people came to the monastery to educate the monks on the issues about the underclass and the way that there was discrimination in Japan around the underclass. And the issue was that the Soto Zen teachings, some of the various teachings on karma, teachings on original enlightenment and things, were actually held in such a way that it reinforced social discrimination. Some of it was quite ugly. And so in Japan there's been all this, you know, whole movement of critical Buddhism, soul searching, trying to understand how might these teachings that we hold so dear been changed or misunderstood or misappropriated, misdirected. The other area of soul searching on ethics is also the kind of research that Brian Victoria has been doing. How is it that Zen teachers in Japan could so actively, through their own teachings, teaching and supporting the war effort, supporting going out and being soldiers and killing other people, what kind of reference does that have towards the precepts? You know, if they're building the life on the precepts, which seem self-evident what it means to us, how is it that they, basing their life on the same precepts, come to such a radically different conclusion about war and killing that perhaps we have here? So I'm not suggesting an answer to this, I'm just pointing out that there's this very deep soul searching going on in our tradition. And I imagine that some of you as well have been involved in this and thinking about this. So the history of the precepts is pertinent for these kinds of questions. I'd like to say that there are three different areas to look at when we talk about the history of precepts. One is a literal formulation of what the precepts actually are. And it was a surprise to me when I looked at it to see how it's changed over the centuries. And yet you'll see, I was surprised that the 10 precepts, 10 great precepts that Dogen lists in the classical Jukai, are different than the 10 precepts that the current Soto Zen in Japan use, or that any of our groups here think use as well. So how do we get from Dogen to us? And what does it mean in the transmission of the precepts if we're not transmitting the precepts literally the way that Dogen had it? What are we transmitting? So we can look first at the literal wording of the precepts and where they came from. The second is we can look at the history of the practice of the precept, how the precepts were practiced. And the third is we can look at the history of how the precepts have been understood, the theory, the Buddhology, the Dharmology that supports the interpretation of the precepts. The precepts require interpretation because life is so complex that you can't just apply it directly. So what is the background for that understanding? And we can look at historical changes over time over that understanding. And each of us here are part of this historical development. And it's interesting to place ourselves within the historical development as opposed to assuming that we're part of the ahistorical tradition and that we're offering ahistorical, non-historical teachings of the absolute truth. This is the way it is. And so... So if you understand that it's a history changing over time, where in that sequence of history, historical changes, do we look to for guidance and inspiration? So an interesting perspective on Soto Zen precepts comes from a 14th century Soto Zen teacher who wrote, "The Buddha's precepts are the most important affair of our school. Since antiquity, they have been transmitted from Buddha to patriarch to me. When someone arouses his religious aspiration and receives the precepts, then he or she attains the same level of great enlightenment as the Buddha." This makes three points. The precepts are at the heart of Soto Zen. Two, they have been transmitted in an unbroken lineage. And three, the combination of bodhicitta and the receiving the precepts makes one equal to the Buddha. If this is, if we follow this kind of teachings, then there's a variety of questions that this raises. Are, in fact, the precepts the most important affair of Soto Zen? Are they really at the heart of it? What understanding of the precepts makes it the case? How do we understand the precepts so they can be understood to be the heart of it all? And what is more important, the literal observance of the precepts or some principle behind them? Have the precepts been transmitted in an unbroken lineage? How do we investigate this when we have no historical evidence that Zen practitioners relied on the 16 Bodhisattva precepts before Dogen? What are the intended and unintended consequences of claiming that simply receiving the precepts equals the enlightenment of the Buddha? What are the unintended consequences of that? So in looking at the history of precepts in Soto Zen, it's very important, I believe, to remember that the precepts have represented or have been much more than guidelines for moral behavior. And without understanding that, you don't understand the history of Soto Zen. In fact, the role of the precepts to offer guidelines for moral behavior might have been a minor function over the centuries than actually guiding people's moral behavior. What are some of the other things associated come along with the Soto Zen precepts? One very important one is because it's given in ordination ceremonies, lay and monastic, lay and priest, it creates a karmic connection with the teacher, with the lineage, and with the sect, the tradition of Buddhism. So what comes along is not just the moral behavior, but comes along an identification, a connection that some people feel is very deep. But what does that connection mean? What does that relationship mean? What comes along with that? Also, at times, the precepts have provided people with a mystical connection to an unseen sacred world that so overshadowed the precepts as moral principles that in receiving the precepts, people were not expected to uphold the precepts. So not only were upholding the moral precepts not particularly the main point, you'll find Soto Zen texts in medieval and time of Japan where it's very clear that in giving the precepts and precept ceremonies to lay people, that there was no expectation, explicitly no expectation, that those people would live by the precepts. So that's that function of the precepts to be a moral guide was not part of the transmission. It was rather this karmic connection to the lineage, to some sense of purity, to some sense of Buddhahood, to some kind of other kind of understanding besides the moral understanding that was the important part. And as some of you know, part of the reason they say that Soto Zen was so successful in spreading across Japan was because the monks would go around and use the precept ordination to subdue the local kami. So again, the precepts have other functions besides moral behavior. They have this kind of almost magical power to them that was used. And so a little bit repeating myself, historically many Buddhist monks have not interpreted the precepts as something to be followed literally. Certainly, we have enough abundant evidence of ethical laxity in Japanese Buddhism that it would seem that it is not the literal meaning of the precepts which was important. So I say that partly as a doctrine, I'm going to go over some of the literal kind of transmission of the actual precepts. But maybe that misses the point. Maybe that misses the heart of it, or the spirit of it, or something wider that went along with the transmission of the precepts. And I would also say that the very idea of Jukai, of granting the precepts, the very idea of Denpo, transmitting the precepts, suggests something much more than the precepts functioning as moral guidance. There's something being transmitted, and the question then, or the issue then, what else is being transmitted? What else comes along with that? And how can we talk about it? How can we make that clear? It's interesting that Dogen has very little to say about the precepts, except that they're important. But he doesn't, as far as I know, go into much explanation about what they are. He's much more interested in the Zen and Shin. He's much more interested in the monastic code of conduct than he is in the precepts. In fact, the impression I get from reading Dogen, the primary value of the precepts was in the role as in the ordination ceremonies. They're part of the organization, the change of kind of status of the person. And that was their role. And in certainly in medieval Japan, that seems to have been their primary role. And once a person is ordained, the role of the priestess as moral guidance seems to fall away. And I'd love to hear you argue against this. And this is quite different, I think, than here in the modern West. I suspect that a fair number of you are quite happy to lecture your Dharma talks and the precepts, because they seem to be a very useful way of addressing, especially a lay audience, supporting people in their life and their practice life, and developing the precepts and kind of applying them in all kinds of different situations in their lives in a way that perhaps wasn't necessary in the monastic situation, where the monastic rules and culture is to protect people's behavior in certain bounds. Okay, so as you know, the Soto Zen precepts can be divided into three categories: the three refuges, the three pure precepts, and the 10 grave or major precepts. The three refuges, I don't think I need to say much about. That seems clearly to be the unbroken lineage, going back at least as far as the Buddha, historical Buddha. And so ubiquitous in Buddhism that talking about history of it is not much point, except perhaps the meaning, the understanding of what refuge means maybe has changed. But then we look at the three pure precepts. And then it gets a little more interesting. So if we can put that one up. Translation, I think here's Zen Center, most of the Zen Center use of the three precepts, three pure precepts is do no evil, do good, and save all beings. This seems to go very similar to a verse in Dhammapada. Do no evil, do good, purify the mind. This is the teachings of the Buddhas. And in fact, Dogen, in his classical on doing no evil, quotes this quote, though he attributes it to a different place. But it attributes it from the early Buddhist tradition, the Agamas. And so Dogen knew about this quote, and it seems like this is a reasonable assumption that the original origin for the pure precepts is this particular verse. The problem with that is has to do with sloppy English translation. And first, the Dhammapada verse does not say do no good, do good. What it said, am I speaking loud enough and slow enough and fast enough? Just like, anybody want to complain or ask for a change? What? Slower? Okay. I will try to speak slower. Dharma talk speed. So.
Too slow.
I'm a little bit aware that it's after lunch.
The middle way.
So, Pali says second line, which is translated as doing good, literally says engage or practice what is kusala. Kusala means skillful. Do what's skillful. And that skillful is a much more nuanced meaning than good. Good is so vague. What does that mean? And kusala is a very rich and very important term in the early Buddhist tradition, the idea of skillful. For one thing, skillful, primarily in his early tradition, has to do with looking at your own mental qualities, mental states of mind, and if those mental states of mind are skillful. Okay, so we'll get back to this. I think this is a very important point. We'll get back to it. Then the problem with the translation of the Soto Zen pure precepts, if you can put the other one up on that board. And some of you, I think, have addressed this problem.
Is the Do No Evil a pretty good translation?
So that's what you see next.
Oh, okay.
So this next is a translation of a more literal translation of Dogen's version of and so the Japanese Soto Zen version of the three pure precepts.
Is that scripted up to read?
So taking on codes and discipline. Why do we say do no evil? That's pretty different, isn't it? Or close enough? You're happy with it? This is an interpretive translation that's used repeatedly. Even in some of the translations of Dogen works, they use this interpretive translation.
It's a way of doing no evil.
It's a way of doing no evil, right. And here, I think Rev. Anderson, as you know, some of you know, has been even more creative in translating this because he went back and looked at the Chinese and saw the Chinese did not say do no evil. It said something much closer to this than the one over there about codes of discipline. The in the Dogen's classical Jukai, he basically says or implies pretty clearly that taking on codes and discipline. Codes is the word Japanese ritsu. And ritsu is the word, the character, that's used to translate vinaya. This is very important, vinaya. So I translated it as codes here, but it could be something else. And here in the Jukai classical, he associates taking on codes and discipline with doing no evil. And in fact, the history of this particular formulation probably goes back to the 7th century in China, where there was a vinaya master named Daozhang, and he seems to be his wording this way, and he makes it very explicit that and it's understood down through the centuries that what this first precept means, it means the precepts of restraint, restraining from doing evil. So this is an interpretive translation based on the traditional interpretation that these are the precepts of restraint and to avoid doing evil. What's very important about this is that the word is ritsu, vinaya. And it tells us that Dogen, in using it, was part of a very movement in Kamakura, Japan, that was trying to revive discipline, codes, and vinaya. And in fact, in Kamakura times, with Eisai and some of the other Rinzai teachers coming in, they were as much seen as vinaya masters as they were seen as Zen masters in their own times. And they were trying to revive the traditional vinaya of the, what we nowadays would call the Hinayana vinaya, into Japanese Buddhism. It had been dropped by Saicho, and there was lots of reports from that time about how decadent many of the Buddhist monks, especially the Buddhist monks coming out of the Tendai tradition, how corrupt they were. They had standing armies. They would go out and fight each other. They'd fight the government. They would do all kinds of wonderful, fascinating things. And it seems that the precepts that they did have were not being followed. So people like Eisai were trying to revive them, and they went to China. And in China, it was unheard of that someone would be a Zen monk and not be ordained, a full Zen monk, including being a Zen teacher, without being ordained in the traditional 250 precepts of the Shravaka precepts. So there was a lot of discussion going on in Kamakura about vinaya. And Dogen was part of that movement, and he was also trying to emphasize the importance of discipline and codes. But he did it in a kind of, at least in my eyes, trying to understand it, a confused way. Or I'm confused, trying to understand what Dogen was trying to do with vinaya. And we'll get to that a little bit later. So, codes and discipline. The second interesting thing is the second line of the pure precepts does not literally say, do good. It says, taking on good qualities. And if you remember, the word kusala refers to qualities of heart or mind, inner states of mind, having good qualities, like developing the paramitas would be developing good qualities. So the first is precepts of restraint. The second is developing yourself internally, cultivating yourself with the paramitas, for example. And so when you see that in a translation, do good, that's, what does that mean? You know, bring soup to the, you know, bring food to the soup kitchen? Maybe, but taking on good qualities has an internal aspect of personal development, and that's lost in the common English translation. Okay? Yes, please.
I just want to ask this question of clarity on this. Kusala is skillful, because in English, skillful, you know, there's a lot of very skillful embezzlers out there and skillful housebreakers. And,
right.
So how does that, I always thought of kusala more as wholesome, nourishing, beneficial.
Right. It's common to translate kusala as wholesome. In the early Buddhist tradition, it's over and over and over referred to having proficiency in certain kind of in certain capacities that lead to certain results. So it's a little bit goal-oriented. There's a sense of purpose and direction you're going, and that which is supportive of that direction you're going, that which is skillful and beneficial in moving in a certain direction.
So it implies the wholesome side, it implies the beneficial side.
It implies more than beneficial or wholesome. Wholesome, which is nourishing, might not imply that something is skillful.
What I'm saying is that skillful implies wholesome.
Yes. I hope so. And at the end of the talk, I'm going to come back to this. But this is an important point of my whole presentation. So, if it is okay, wait. Someone else? Yes.
I just wanted to say, the students I teach, I use the word skillful a lot.
Who does?
In the students that I teach, I use the word skillful a lot. Particularly when I teach guiding books on the way. And people like the word skillful because it takes out the connotation of you're bad when you're not skillful. So it's a very neutral term in certain ways. It makes it easier for people to feel better about their practice and the way they conduct that and go about doing that.
Good. Good. And then the last one, it says, more literal translation of the Japanese, we benefited sentient beings. And I would say that's a little bit different than what we mean, our implications, than how we use it here at Zen Center, how we translate it here at Zen Center, where it's saving all beings. Is that still a current way to say it at Zen Center? It's a little bit more idealistic or grand to save all beings. It's a little bit more modest, I think. They just benefited them. It implies a wider range of possible behavior.
Bill?
Yes?
So you sort of slid over this. Do you feel there is any echo or resonance between Dogen's formulation of pure precepts and the Dhammapada verse? Or do you think they have a completely separate source?
It's a good question. It's hard to know, but it seems that my guess, and little I know about the history of Buddhism, is that these three from the Dhammapada were seen as being kind of categories which later Mahayana Buddhists used to divide up and explain all kinds of different behavior. And so by the time he came to China with the 7th century Vinaya master, he also adopted this here as a way of categorizing different kinds of Buddhist behavior, precepts, or activity. In fact, this guy, Dao Xuan, he was the one who seems to have said that following, that do no evil is the practice, the precepts of the Nirmanakaya. And doing good is the precepts of the Sambuddhakaya. And that benefiting all sentient beings is the precepts of the Dharmakaya. And that's a very interesting kind of buddhology, because in making that kind of hierarchy, it's easy to give priority and higher value to the Dharmakaya, which means that perhaps the Nimanakaya precepts aren't as important. And if the Dharmakaya precepts are the kind of the traditional Vinaya, it's easier to dismiss them. And this we'll see is what happened repeatedly in the Mahayana, was a kind of a process of both dismissing and then reviving the use of the Vinaya. Yes?
I've heard another troubling very pure precept, which is go beyond the Vinaya.
Yes. I mean, there's a translation of this? Or? At Zen Center for a while, they had, for the first one, they had don't engage in anything that gives rise to attachments. So that's also an interpretive translation. Yes?
I take it to using clarify the mind for the benefit of all beings.
Oh, you combine them two. So Barbara says she says the third one is clarifying the mind to benefit all beings.
Or for the benefit of all
beings. Isn't that brilliant? It harmonizes it all. So I find this very interesting, the way in which we're willing to shift and change the precepts because of what it means about what we're transmitting. And I think it's a call to be a little more self-conscious about what underlies the values, the assumptions that underlies the very idea of what we're transmitting if we're willing to change the wording from how we receive it.
I think that Buddhism, you know, Buddhists are just human beings, and they tend to fall into dualistic ways of thinking and say, well, because this one, this is the best one, and this is the best one. And so instead of realizing that all the various levels on which precepts are presented and practiced are all equally valid and all reinforce each other, and all. And I also take a little bit of issue. I think that the three treasures are the center of precept, the basis. The first one, be Buddha, and all the rest are interpreted as explanations of how to do that. So I think that's why I got into Vipassana, although he valued the moral precepts. He felt that if we practice as Buddha, then that would all be folded into, you know, the interesting outcomes of practice.
Right.
So I think a lot of these problems arise through picking and choosing.
Yes, I would tend to agree with, partly because I want to be provocative, if I may, Sensei. Is you find in the history of Zen and in Buddhism, a variety of times where non-dualistic teachings of beyond good and evil, going back to Buddha nature, going back to a pure mind, going back to Buddha, has been then translated into it's okay to kill.
Right, that's a perversion.
Okay.
Beyond good and evil,
then accepting them. So the point being, I'm not criticizing, I'm not challenging what you're saying. What I'm challenging is that it's very easy to take that kind of teaching and slide off. And so I think that what's, for this purpose, in terms of history, I'm interested in what understanding do we hold, and what are the unintended consequences of some of the ways in which we word the precepts. Even when the precepts are being expressed with the best possible understanding, how do we slip and slide?
I think the higher understanding like that is presented to various disciples that have good understanding in
Can you repeat that?
No, we can't hear you over here.
Please repeat what Mel said.
I said that.
I had trouble hearing all of it, but Mel says that he hopes that the transmission of the precepts, like this kind of understanding, would only be transmitted to disciples that they have a lot of confidence in and mature.
And that's just everybody, because there wouldn't be
converted of misunderstanding. I would like for you to get back to the historical story, because you left us hanging there.
Good.
You were saying that Dogen was, and the people of his time were trying to bring Vinaya back. Right. And then you also said that in the medieval period, the precepts were not moral rules, but were kind of magic. Mm-hmm. So how did we get from Dogen, who was trying to clean up things, to no moral precepts, not as moral practices. So there's a story there. You tell us that story.
Okay.
You also said Dogen was confused.
Or you were.
No, I'm confused.
We want to hear about that confusion.
I'm going to hear about my confusions. I'm mostly concerned that you stay away. Okay.
Confusion wipes us out.
What?
Confusion
wakes you up. Okay, so let me go on then to the 10 great precepts, the 10 major precepts. And so the 10 Zen precepts, I think we can fairly confidently say, have their origins in two lists that go back to the earliest time in Buddha, Buddhist time. And I keep referring to the Pali tradition, only because that's the one I know the most about. And there are other kind of early traditions and texts that we could refer to. Just allow me the permission to just kind of keep referring to the Pali. So in the Pali tradition, the first list is what's nominally called nowadays the five precepts. And however, to use the word precepts for these five maybe lends to the overall confusion that exists in Buddhism around discussion about the precepts. So those five precepts, I think you all know, are to abstain from harming. Well, let me give you the literal. This might be interesting for you to hear the literal and deal with the literal. Abstain from harming breathing things. To abstain from taking what is not given. To abstain from sexual misconduct. To abstain from false speech. To abstain from alcohol, liquor, or spirits that are caused for heedlessness.
Could you repeat the last?
To abstain from alcohol, liquor, or spirits that are a cause for heedlessness. This at least, if you look at the Pali Canon, these five things are sometimes referred to as sila, and sila shouldn't be translated as precepts, but should be translated as virtues. And surprisingly, these five virtues are not discussed very much in the Pali Canon, much less than you would have expected. I think in the modern world, people have a strong association of the five precepts with Theravada Buddhism, and Zen does the 10 precepts. But in the early tradition, it doesn't seem that the five precepts were mentioned or that important. They're mentioned for sure. But one of the common ways they're mentioned is not as prescriptions for how to behave, but rather descriptions of how someone who's a sotapanna, a shotapanna, a stream enter, would behave. So they become expressive rather than, we would say in our language perhaps of Buddha nature, more than something that's prescribed and lived by. But in any case, the five precepts don't have such a central role. Historically, it turns out, it is not the monopoly of Theravada Buddhism to have the five precepts. The five precepts are pan-Buddhist. And they exist in Tibetan Buddhism, they exist in Chinese Buddhism, they exist in Japanese Buddhism for many hundreds of years. Probably right up until a couple of centuries ago, they were important. And I've been told that in Shan Buddhism, a lay person going to a Chan monastery in Taiwan today to do sashin will take the five precepts. They're still part and parcel of that. So it's a mistake to see them as being only belonging to early Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism. But if you go back to early Buddhism, they don't have such a big role. That's interesting. What does? What seems to have a much bigger role is not the five precepts, but rather a different list. And so you can put up the next one, and you can just put it over that one there. And this is called the 10 skillful actions, kusala kamapadas. And this is, I believe, the ancestor of the Zen precepts. And there's a couple of interesting things here. One is, this is not a precept list, the way we think of precepts. It's called skillful actions. And here again, we have the word skillful. And so this word skillful becomes important, and that's what I want to come back to at the end of the talk.
What was the word you said? The word, you said kusala something.
10 skillful actions. Kusala kama padas. And it's the word karma, so it's 10 karma here means action, but it also relates to the whole teaching what karma is about. So 10 karmic skillful actions, or 10 karmic skills to have. And so for those people who can't read it, I'm going to read it quickly. Abstain from killing, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, and from false speech. Those, I think, you know, are familiar, right? The first four. And the next one, F5, is abstaining from malicious speech, from harsh speech, from gossip, from covetousness, from ill will, and the last piece of it is having right to you. This is not a perfect match for the Zen precepts, but it gets kind of close. So now, Beth, if you can put up the other one. These are Dogen's 10 great precepts. And I'm hoping, in terms of keeping you awake, that you're going to be, some of you are going to be surprised when you see what the precepts that Dogen actually wrote about. Because they're different than what we're used to here in the West. So the first one is no killing, then no stealing, no indulging in lewdness, no corrupt speech. And then the fifth one is no selling of alcohol. Some of you know this. I was really surprised how much alcohol there was in the training monasteries in Japan where I was at. And to my naive assumption was that they were breaking the precepts. But it turns out they weren't. There's no precept against drinking alcohol among the 10 precepts. It's against selling alcohol. And then the sixth one, no talking of the faults of lay and monastic bodhisattvas. Now, I thought that was pretty interesting, because literally that implies it's okay to talk about the faults of everybody else. Well, it's easy to argue it doesn't. However, historically, you find in Mahayana, Chinese Mahayana and Japanese Mahayana, a tremendous amount of literature and teachings about not only disparaging the Hinayana, disparaging the Shravakas, but actually Mahayana sutras that talk about that it's okay to kill Shravakas, it's okay to kill and defend the true Dharma against these other bad people. It's quite powerful, the rhetoric at least. It goes against the other kind of schools. So historically, we might want to interpret it differently. But if you look at the historical context of the times, it seems relatively reasonable to assume this is what they really meant. And I'll go back to that again in a little bit. No praising self or disparaging others. No coveting dharma or wealth. No being angry. And the last one, not slandering the three treasures. These are all very familiar to us, and I'm very happy with slandering the three treasures. I kind of came into me like mother's milk, because I was a Dharma student, and I always took it as a wonderful thing. But lately, I've been kind of questioning this a little bit as I study the history of Buddhism. And when I look at the comparison between the skillful actions and the 10 great precepts, what's been shifted historically is from right view to not disparaging the three precepts, the three treasures. And the difference is that this one here has to do about orientation, perspective, how to practice. That one there has to do about protecting Buddhism, having an identity about you're not disparaging, you know, it's a wonderful treasure that we have. It's certainly possible to make an interpretation that says it'd be the same thing. But literally, I think right now we just take the literal kind of difference. And so, and if you go along with me, that the strong identification of the bodhisattva community against other communities is part of the great precepts, the way it was written, then perhaps we can kind of a little bit more willing to look at the 10th precept as being another example of kind of us versus them, or kind of self-identity as being a part of what's going on here. Yes.
There's another interpretation for the 10th one.
Yes, please. There's another interpretation of the 10th one.
From the Chinese, not interpretation, but reasoning.
Yeah.
Is that when you do that, then you create bad karma for yourself.
Yes.
And it's not so much that the three treasures can't, you know, take care of themselves, but it's that you create bad karma for yourself.
Yes. As another interpretation is that it's not so much about protecting the three treasures, which don't need protection, but rather it has to do with not creating bad karma for yourself. And then it's interesting, though, to go back historically, the context of those sutras that say that it's okay to kill in order to protect the Dharma. So there's still sutras in our tradition, Mahayana tradition, that say that. So, you know, how do we, you know, that's not interpreted. That's, so then a few other things about, if you compare these two lists. What's missing in this list here, in the 10 skillful actions, is the precept about alcohol. There's nothing about against alcohol in this list here. And so what we find historically is that this list of 10 skillful actions was very important in much of Indian Buddhism. And it was important throughout Buddhism, both the so-called Nikaya Buddhism or Shravaka Buddhism, and also in the Mahayana Buddhism or the Bodhisattva Buddhism. And you find like Abhidhamsaka Sutra lists these skillful actions as the 10 precepts of the Bodhisattva, exactly the same list. But you find other places in both or all of the Indian traditions where they're using these lists of 10, but it looks very much like they're missing. They're concerned about the absence of the one about alcohol. And so they take the one with alcohol from the 5 precept list and insert it here. And you have such oddities then that in some sutras you have a statement where it says that they're not going to list the 10 precepts, and they list 11. These 10 here, these 10 skillful actions, plus inserted into it the precept on alcohol. I guess some people didn't want to have 11, so there are different Indian texts. You'll see that they took out one of the skillful actions having to do with speech in order to insert the one on alcohol and maintain, 10. That make sense? Okay. So this was happening in dozens, hundreds of different texts. It happened a little bit creatively. It doesn't seem to have been a single unitary kind of lineage for doing that. It seems to have been many people were doing this in India at the same time. And sometimes the place that alcohol had in the list was it did not miss the 5th, but sometimes other places because they were just inserting it.
So yes. Was it literally alcohol, or was it alcohol and drugs? Did it include anything that affected the mind?
I'm not so sure about the wording, but I think it's pretty, with some confidence I'll say that as long as it was being done in Sanskrit or Indian languages, it was the same as the Pali, which is to avoid alcohol, spirits, drinks that intoxicate the mind or bring on heedlessness. In the Pali tradition, there's a controversy about the grammar. You interested in the controversy of grammar on drinking alcohol?
Sure.
And of course, it's a controversy, meaning there are people who are going to. There's two sides. And people are very sure that what the grammar says is thou shalt not drink alcohol. There are other people who say, the way the grammar is worded, it says, do not drink alcohol up to the point of becoming heedless. Which one's right?
who gets
to decide? But anyway, the answer is I think that as long as it's in India, it's like the Pali. It's pretty consistent. When you get to translating into Chinese, that's where they kind of simplified it. And mostly it's alcohol they refer to there, not drugs. And that's an R kind of thing. Yes, please. Yes.
I just wanted to flag that we're covering enormous distances in time and geography and culture as we're hopping between these lists.
Right.
We're not talking about entrenched cultural attitudes about alcohol or sexuality, which has to come into this, as does the question of what are actual human beings going to do with this stuff.
Right.
So this is, it's hard to contextualize a historical discussion with that stuff, but I think it's pretty important.
I think thank you for saying that. And it is a caricature to go over simplistically. It's a much more complex area. But I think it's as an introduction to this area, I think it's relatively accurate. But it brings up an interesting point that historically, maybe what's more important for people's behavior, how they behave, is a cultural context of expectations than it is for the actual precepts people are following. So what the precepts are is secondary, perhaps, to what your community of people expect, how they expect you to behave. And so behavior like alcohol, for example, has more to do with your community than perhaps what the actual precepts say. So is that along the line what you're saying? Yeah. So we'll get to that, because then we'll see what happens in China. Yes?
I was going to mention that I trained in Japan, and the teaching that I received there, the term for precept sometimes in Japanese is kaiitsu. There's a kai and a itsu. But a very explicit teaching that the precepts that are being maintained are not kai mitsu, but simply kai. And that the mitsu, which are the rules, are something different than what the precepts are. And so I think there is alive, in modern day Japan at least, some understanding that there was a division between the Vinaya approach and then what these precepts recommended present, and it's then reflected in the language very directly, and people speak about it in those ways with that kind of a division. Then when we move to English, whether the text says kai or the text says kaiitsu, we translate as precepts, and it's difficult for us then to make the same distinction.
Yes, and so a few things. One is that after Dogen, there was periodically in Soto Zen big controversies or concerns or explorations about what the relationship that Soto Zen precepts were to Vinaya. And the last time this happened historically in a way that really got Soto Zen's attention was when Obaku Zen came to Japan, because they were Chinese monks who, it was inconceivable to them that someone who was not ordained in the 250 precepts. And then when they came to Japan, it was a real surprise to the Soto Zen establishment that people actually followed these Charvaka precepts, and what is our relationship to it? And, you know, so they were kind of trying to sort that out.
Just as a sideline, I remember Trungpa Rinpoche saying the trouble with breaking the fifth precept is that you lose your judgment and you break all the rest.
Trungpa said the problem with the fifth precept is that you lose your judgment and you break all the other precepts as a result. So it's the 10 great precepts of Dogen have a very clear source, and that is a sutra called the Brahma Jala Sutra, the Brahma Net, scripture of the Brahma Net. And that discourse was so-called translated into Chinese around the middle of the 5th century. The timing of the translation was very important because in the decades before that, it was one of the first time the traditional Vinaya from India was translated in its fullness into Chinese. And the first time the Chinese were trying to deal and grapple with the whole issue of Vinaya and ordination on their own soil in a way they couldn't before because they didn't have the full Vinaya text. At the same time, in the 5th century, was when the Chinese Buddhists were really coalescing around a very strong sectarian identity as being Mahayana Buddhists, in opposition to the Hinayana. So, and these two, and as these two things came together, the Chinese started to kind of question about this idea of taking on Hinayana precepts, and they started questioning whether these Indian precepts were really right for them. Luckily, the Brahma Net Sutra appeared. And among other things, it talks about how very important following precepts it is to have filial piety.
Yeah.
Now, isn't that a Chinese cultural idea? Well, I don't know what kind of evidence has been marshaled for this point exactly, but it's, the scholars who study these early texts and translations will call the Brahmanet Sutra apocryphal. If they're not being polite, they call it a forgery. It seems pretty clear that it was written in China. It was not a translation. It was written to address the concerns of the Chinese, or some Chinese, in the middle of the 5th century. And one of the concerns was, we have such a strong Mahayana identity in opposition to the Hinayana. In such a strong way that I don't think probably ever existed in India, where the two traditions were much more kind of overlapped and interwoven. And that strong separation, they said, well, we need to have our own precepts, the Bodhisattva precepts. There was sometimes these skillful actions in various formulations were sometimes called Bodhisattva precepts in Indian Buddhism. So the idea of Bodhisattva precepts kind of was there already. But it wasn't quite enough for whoever was coming up with the Brahmanet Sutra. And so Brahmanet Sutra came up with 10 major precepts. And, yes?
So what they were, so when you first said that, it sounded as if you were saying that filial piety would support keeping the Indian precepts.
No.
But that's not
what I'm saying. The simplest point, that is that in the Brahmanet Sutra, one of the kind of precepts or emphasis is there is the importance of filial piety. Which is a very big Chinese concern.
Excuse me.
Yes.
But it's also not absent from the account.
Yes, it's not absent, but you have to kind of take and squeeze the juice out of the raisin to get it.
No, it's explicitly stated in some of the minor Nikayas.
They take raisin and squeeze it out. It's there, but it's not a very strong emphasis. You find it a little bit, and it's not only minor, you find it in the Digha Nikaya, in the Sigalavaka Sutta. You find it there as well. But it's nothing to the degree in the centrality that you find it in Chinese. And so I don't want to belabor the point. I'm happy to be wrong. I'd like to go on. Is that okay? So for example, Brahma Jala says, you must obey your parents, teachers, monks, and the three jewels. Filial piety and obedience are the ultimate path. Filial piety is called the precepts. So you don't find that kind of emphasis in the Pali Canon, do you? Not that kind of way, I don't think. So somehow in this, whoever was coming up with the Brahmanet Sutra borrowed this list here, or borrowed these, as they would be morphed and changed in Mahayana. They adopted these as the 10. I don't know of any earlier precedent for the 10th precept being disparaging the three treasures. I also don't know any precedent where the 5th precept is called not selling alcohol. Now, the precepts of Brahmanet Sutra were also used for lay ordinations. And so, and China probably had a very different relationship to alcohol than they had in India. And so, the idea that selling is a problem, not drinking, is part of it. However, the minor precepts, the 48 minor precepts in the Brahmajala Sutra, I think it's the second one or third one, says no drinking alcohol. Yes. Yes, 48. 10 major and 48 minor.
10 major and 48 minor.
Yeah. Yes. So once you put not drinking alcohol to become a minor precept, it has a very minor role.
Minor precepts.
They're local precepts.
Yeah, so they took Chinese character, and in Japan we have minor precepts, which people don't recognize.
Right.
Whatever.
great. So we're part of this, as part of this historical development.
Can you restate what Nelson said?
I'd like to go on because
well, no one heard.
I know, but may I just go on, please? So that part of the function of the Brahmanette's precepts would be used as bodhisattva ordinations. At some point, they felt that they needed some kind of ordination into the Mahayana because they had this Hinayana ordination, but that wasn't quite enough. So this became an important source in China for ordination ceremonies. In China, as for the most part, for monastics, for monks, it was always clear that to become a full monk, you had to be ordained in the Shravaka 250 precepts, as well as in these if you're going to be a bodhisattva monk. They didn't supplement the earlier precepts. They were added on top of them. And then I think many of you know that then Saicho in Japan in the 8th century, he became the great champion for doing away entirely with the earlier Vinaya, the earlier ordination in the Hinayana Vinaya. And he argued the reason for that was that he felt that the explicit reason for that was that they're Hinayana and we're Mahayanists and it's a violation of our Mahayana spirits and vows to be taking the Hinayana precepts. The political reason for doing it perhaps was that the government, both in China and Japan, but in Japan, the government controlled ordination very tightly. Who got ordained and when and all that. And there was the places to get ordained as a monk in Japan at that time was at Nara, at the Nara temples. And Saicho was out at the outskirts of Kyoto trying to create his own tradition. And he was losing some of his monks. Some of his prospective monks would go to Nara to get ordained and never come back. And so he wanted to establish institutional separation and freedom from the Nara temples. And so he petitioned to the government for permission to create his own ordination ceremony and his own ordination platform. And he asked to do it with these precepts. And eventually, right after he died, he was granted that right. And then the Tendai then began to ordain people with the 58 Brahmajala precepts. Not the 10, but the 58. However, as the Tendai developed over the next centuries, from every source that I've seen, every secondary writing I've read, it points out that the Tendai became looser and looser with the precepts. Partly because there was no interpretation, explanation, commentary on how to live the precepts, and partly because they started to supplement the precepts with other kind of, these precepts with other precepts. Anen, who was a century or so after Saicho, explicitly said that it was okay to violate these bodhisattva precepts as long as you maintain your samaya precepts. Samaya, and this is tantric Buddhism, this Vajrayana Buddhism is coming into the mix here. And the samaya precepts are not to abandon the true Dharma, never to abandon the aspiration to enlightenment, never to refuse to confer Buddhist teachings on someone who sincerely wishes to study them and to benefit sentient beings. So those take precedent over these precepts.
Could you read those?
Not to abandon the true Dharma, never to abandon aspiration to enlightenment, never to refuse to confer Buddhist teachings on someone who sincerely wishes to study them to benefit sentient beings. So this allowed kind of to hold the precepts lighter and lighter. And in fact, there's lots of examples. And historically, the time of the Buddha, the time of Tendai Buddhism in Japan, they were notorious for being lax with the precepts of Tendai Monastery. And people complained about it, they tried to do some things about it, and various things. And even Suzuki Roshi, when he was studying in college, wrote about the laxity of the Tendai monks. So there you have it. And so into this mix then comes the Zen, people introduced Zen to Japan. And now you can maybe understand a little bit more why they were so interested in reinvigorating or reintroducing the Vinaya, because it traditionally gotten so lax ethically. So Dogen. So what's the what relationship did Dogen have to these to these precepts? And where did he get it, where did he get them from? It's possible that he received them from the Tendai ordination, and he just took the 10 major precepts, and these others, the other two categories of precepts, kind of were in the ordination ceremony for the Tendai, and so he just kind of simplified it down. That's one interpretation. Another interpretation is that he received this from Tendo Gyojo, his teacher in China. We do have a record of him getting some kind of precept transmission, or something, ordination, from Tendo Gyojo. And Dogen seems to have put a lot of store, a lot of value in that ordination that he got, that precept ordination he got, initiation he got. And I think as someone who's kind of familiar with Chinese Buddhism at that time, would think that Dogen's high esteem of his precept transmission was a little bit overdone. That by that time in China, the Chinese Shan masters had developed a custom, a pattern of ordaining lay people using Bodhisattva precepts, and a simplified version of the Brahmajala's precepts. And when when this young guy came from Japan, it was kind of like a matter of course that Tendai Gyojo would offer him these precepts. He was doing, Chinese were doing it a lot to lay people at that time. And Dogen's status as a monk was always a little bit ambiguous. It was a little ambiguous exactly how much a monk he was when he went to China and what was going on there. So he got this precept ordination, and he thought it was the best thing that ever happened to him, almost. But for Tendai Gyojo, it could be that he was just doing something he did, a dime a dozen. That's an interpretation. Evidence, how do we argue from the evidence when we have mostly have evidence of absence? So anything else we say is kind of, we don't have much evidence to go by. Yes?
Were those precepts going to Tendai in Japan?
Yes. So I think because of these Chinese Brahmajala Sutra precepts, they were also being used in China. And so, how these Chinese use of them and how the Tendai use of them coalesced around Dogen is not so clear. So what we do, what's very interesting is there was a fascicle Jukai by Dogen, and you read it. In the beginning of it, he quotes the Seven Shingi, the monastic codes from China. Just as Esai also quoted it. And both these Zen teachers quote the Seven Shingi, emphasizing how important it is to be ordained or follow the Shravaka precepts in the traditional ordination. So Dogen quotes that and says how important it is. And Dogen says, all the Buddhas and patriarchs have always had the Shravaka ordination, the precepts. And then he's going to talk about it, the ceremony. And then instead of talking about that, he talks about the Bodhisattva ordination, the Jukai ordination, pretty much kind of like how we know it now. And then at the very end, the last sentence of Jukai, he says, almost like a footnote, or kind of like, quietly, he says, of course, something like, of course, there have been occasional examples of patriarchs who are not ordained in the Shravaka precepts.
Was he himself?
This is what we don't know. It's kind of, we don't know whether Dogen was ordained that way. It seems very odd that he would not be, because it seems like Esai was really into it, and to Yozet, he probably should have been. But it seems like he had some trouble when he went to China, being recognized as a monk, so what that was about. So there might be people who know more than I do around this. I don't know enough about it, but there seems to be a lot of vagueness around exactly what his ordination was. Yes?
Well, your comment that he may have gotten a kind of a layperson's ordination. Isn't there another story of Dogen, though, that he was offered a high position at that monastery? In which case, why would he be given layperson's ordination?
Well, it wasn't so much a layperson's ordination. It was an ordination that was used both for lay and monastics to initiate them into the Bodhisattva precepts. So both lay and monastics were given the same set of precepts, just like in modern Japan. Soto Zen, we get basically the same precepts, right, to lay and monastic ordination.
I'm just referring to your dime a dozen comment. Is that like inferior ordination?
Well, I don't know how to say it, but maybe, for example, someone comes here from Mars, who's really into, you know, Buddhism and all that, and they walk into Zen Center, and we say, this is a good kid. You know, we're going to have a lay Jukha ceremony this afternoon. We want you to come along, and we'll give you this piece of paper, and, you know, it's good to support you. And that person says, wow, look what just happened to me. You know, I just got this really powerful transmission now that I've been recognized as something really important, like the next best thing from Mars. And I go back to Mars and say, I got this really important, powerful, special transmission in my tradition from my teacher around these, like, you know, around these precepts. That person's high esteem of what the ceremony was like back in Mars has a little bit different connotations than how it's been popularly held here. That same analogy, then, I'm trying to say, maybe happened in China. Is that Dogen was either confused or chose to be kind of to hold up his ordination in a way that probably wasn't. Historical evidence in China is that kind of ordination was not such a special thing in the way that he held it up.
So again, isn't that contradictory to the idea that you have then been offered a high position in the monastery?
I don't know about that. Maybe he had. I know, because maybe if he had been ordained. I think that it's fair to say that in order to have a high position in a Chinese monastery, you had to be ordained in the Sravaka precepts. The government wouldn't allow it any other way. So if he had it, the Sravaka precepts is what he needed to have, and he needed to have the Bodhisattva precepts. But the Bodhisattva precepts were also being given quite freely to the laity. Okay, so next, I want to show you a literal translation of the modern Soto Shu, Japanese Soto Shu, 10 precepts. And maybe you could put it up here in this one. You can compare them with that. I still have your interest?
Yeah.
Modern Japanese
what? This is a literal translation, pretty literal translation, of the modern official version of the 10 precepts in Soto Zen, direct from the manual. This is most basically Brick Folk's translation. So.
This is George Akita.
Yeah. So look and see how much, you know, you recognize your own precepts in this. So not to kill beings, not to steal, not to misuse sex, not to engage in false speech, not to sell alcohol, not to point out the faults of others, not to praise oneself or denigrate others, not to be stingy with the Dharma or material things, not to give rise to anger, not to disparage the three treasures. So again, it's not sell alcohol is what it actually says nowadays. That's no different from the Brahmajala Sutta, Sutra. And then, but the sixth one has changed from the time of Dogen. The sixth one, remember, was the one about not talking about the faults of the Bodhisattva community. And now, in modern Japan, it says not talking about the fault of others. It's been universalized to include all beings. It's not particular to a particular community. And in that sense, it's gone back to the more universal principles of the 10 skillful actions, which are not limited to community, more universal. When this change happened, I don't know.
That may have been influenced by our precepts.
Maybe. Yeah, so probably it would be too hard to go back and do the research and find out when this shift was made. I don't know, and Brick Folk doesn't know, isn't it?
Because when you look at the book that was published, the standardization, I think this is in the standardization.
Yes.
And the standardization is a kind of mixture of flow between Japan and
the Japanese Soto Shu manual?
Yeah. And then the manual that has Japanese on one side of the
English. No. This is the very official, all Japanese. What's it called, the manual?
Yeah.
That Quick Folk has just translated. And I think you all get copies of it.
That's almost exactly the way Roshi Tennant had it translated and she came over and whatever.
That's exactly how Kenneth Roshi translated when she came over. Did your tradition and change and morph and change and evolve over time?
Sorry, what?
Did it change and evolve over time, or do you still do the same?
We've changed ours a little bit. For example, the alcohol one was do not sell the wine in dilution, but I think that's an interpretation.
You know, I found this all very interesting how it's changed over time. So I did a very quick search for how the fifth precept is reworded in some of the different Zen groups, some of your groups probably. And as an example of how things have changed, and there's other examples of change as well, but just chose that because it was interesting. So these are some of the ways that this precept has been is being taught or transmitted in Soto Zen groups in America. Not being intoxicated, not selling the wine of delusion, not intoxicating self or others, do not cloud the mind, not being ignorant, not giving or taking drugs, nothing there but alcohol, and not ingesting intoxicants. So each of them probably is very wise and thoughtful in their own way. What's interesting to me in terms of the history of the precepts is what does it say about understanding the precepts and the practice of the precepts? And when we say that the precepts are at the heart of the Zen tradition, and there's an unbroken lineage of transmission of precepts, it seems we can't stand securely on the notion that it's literally the literal wording of the precepts that are being transmitted. There's been enough changes over the centuries, and we are part of that change. So then it behooves us, I think, to then try to explain what are we transmitting if it's not the literal precepts, and how responsible are we for the underlying assumptions, values that go into that change and that shift. So that's, you know, one of the points I want to make. And now finally, I want to say a little bit, go back again to the 10 skillful actions. I said earlier that the five precepts in the Theravada, in the Pali Canon, shouldn't really be called precepts. They're virtues, five virtues. The 10 skillful actions are also not called precepts. They're called 10 skillful actions. And and the idea of skillfulness implies a proficiency for a certain purpose. And so you need to understand or ask, what's the purpose for which this skill is being developed? In the early tradition, it's very clear that the skill, what makes them skillful, these qualities, is how they are connected to the path of liberation. Not how they're connected to morality and moral guidelines, but how they're connected to the path of liberation and how it moves you along that path. It's having some kind of relationship to liberation that somehow connects ten skillful actions. So whoever's practicing them hopefully has some sense, or needs to have some sense, of what that connection is. They're called 10 skillful actions. The word is karma. And karma implies, in this early tradition, that your actions are consequential. So again, the consequences of your actions, you don't just do something for its own sake. You don't do it intuitively or from some form of expression. But you have some sense of taking care of what the consequences of these actions are. And the consequence that the 10 skillful actions are concerned about has to do with the connection to liberation. Primarily in this early tradition, it has to do with your own liberation, you know, in the way in which it supports your own cultivation and purification of mind. And you see that the three pure precepts, the second one has to do with developing kusala qualities, these good qualities of the mind. Again, these inner qualities. What seems to happen in the history of Mahayana Buddhism, a lot happened. It's a really complex tradition. But you find a variety of places where very strong statements are made where the focus of skillful means is not focused on the quality of the means, but rather focused on the quality of the result. So if you can save people, if you can help people, then it's okay to break the precepts. It's okay to kill. Very explicit, it's okay to kill if you save a lot of people. It's okay to kill if you save the Dharma. It's okay to steal. It's okay to do all kinds of stuff, breaking the precepts, for the benefit of others. It could be a very wise approach, but it lends itself to a certain kind of reckless behavior. It lends itself to being willing to break the precepts because, you know, you've been a good student of mine for a long time, but you're a little bit uptight, and I know how to help you. You know, and there have been teachers, Buddhist teachers, who basically said that to their students. And then whether they believe it or not, that, you know, they're willing to give up the precepts in order to stick with their students because it's for their students' welfare, I don't know. But that's been sometimes the way it's been presented. So it lends itself to kind of, you know, to going off in kind of strange directions when you make that kind of argument. And certainly, Mahayana Buddhists have relied on sutras like the Mahapanirvana Sutra for the justification of committing murder and variety of all kinds of wonderful things. There's been very strong statements in the Mahayana Buddhism, that sometimes in a few places, that following the Shravaka precepts breaks the Mahayana precepts. So in that way, are you not supposed to follow them? But if you follow them, you break the spirit of compassion that exists in the Mahayana. Very strong kind of statements. Some of this is a confusion of terms. And I think part of this, I think you have to realize that, you know, is it George Lakoff talked about the importance of framing? How you frame something has a lot to do with then how you can go proceed with your argument. So in Mahayana Buddhism, especially in China and in Japan, they were critical of Shravaka precepts and claimed they had a higher order of precepts than Bodhisattva precepts. And in addition, they had monastic codes. So Dogen was very concerned about monastic codes. The two sources that he quotes the most in the Shobogenzo are the Koan collections and the Sennin Shingi. He's very concerned with monastic codes. And so, you know, we don't do those Shravaka precepts, which are for the, you know, those poor people. We do something higher for Bodhisattva precepts. In addition, we do monastic codes. But that's framing it in the wrong way. The so-called Shravaka precepts are the Shravaka monastic code. Maybe they shouldn't even be called precepts in this big way that we're talking about precepts. Perhaps the closest the early tradition comes to what we would like to call precepts is the 10 skillful actions. And lo and behold, they're very similar to what we use in Zen Buddhism, in Soto Zen. There's some differences. And I think the differences are not necessarily ones we have to adopt, but I think that it's very interesting to look at the differences and to learn from them. And perhaps something about the spirit and background or the rationale for the 10 skillful actions, given that they're our ancestors, that it would be helpful for us to go back and look at them. In particular, I think it's important is the way it focuses on what is skillful is what moves your mind and heart towards a freer, liberated state, what connects you to liberation. And as long as we remember that, then perhaps it's safer to give some priority, or safer to focus on helping other people in a variety of different ways. Because as long as you're responsible for the quality of your own heart and mind, you don't neglect that, then perhaps you can kind of be situational or vary a little bit with the other precepts depending on what the situation is required. But if you don't have that sense of what's going on inside of yourself, then it's a lot easier to go astray as we choose to not follow the precepts literally.
And of course, we can't see ourselves clearly.
So that's, I think in so many ways that's an accurate thing to say, but it's also, I would say, because I want to be provocative, I think it's a dangerous thing to say, because it muddies and confuses the water much too soon. Because there are things we can see fairly clearly. And so if you say too quickly, you can't see it clearly. If you say too quickly, after all, the precepts cannot be followed literally. It lends itself to some idea, oh, I don't have to follow them literally. I'm not supposed to follow them literally. I think that it's very clear. I think I wouldn't be confused if I killed you. I would know it. That's not a confused and lack of clarity kind of issue. So there's some aspects of the precept which are very clear. But then, you know, all the bacteria that I'm swallowing right now and killing, you know, and what's all that about, and how you can get into ambiguity very quickly. But there's value in having clarity and insisting on clarity in certain domains. So I think it's a little bit dangerous to point towards lack of clarity too quickly.
What I was meaning was that if self-referral is the ultimate standard, what I happen to think and feel is the ultimate standard, then I think that's a little bit off to the side.
Great.
Because we can never really see that.
If it's only subjective, then it's a little bit off to the side. So the role of subjective experience and subjective choices is a really important one. And how much subjective choices goes into the history of the precepts, into changing and shifting them over time. And even right down to today, the modern versions of here in America, so does Anne, how much of that is subjective is an interesting question. And is there some such subjective criteria that's more useful than others? What we feel maybe is not so useful. But are there other subjective criteria that might be useful as a reference point for finding our way into our behavior and what we do? And this is where I think we go back to the skillful actions. I think the skillful actions have a kind of a clear compass through which we can try to find our way in this. It's not just based on how we feel, some kind of feeling, touchy feeling kind of way.
So the other observation is based on looking at this big overview. We start off with the Pali Canon, with the Vinaya, with all the 250 precepts, and then it evolved in Japan. We had the Brahmajala precepts, and we had those in addition to them. And now we're in contemporary America, where basically we've dropped all of those, at least in this particular sect, we've dropped all of those minute, here's how you behave, and gone to these 10 or 16 general threads. So all those really specific details about how you restrain one's life and how you practice renunciation have been gracefully or ungracefully put in the closet.
Yes, and so, could you hear okay? So one of the interesting things, though, is the degree to which places like Tassajara are reintroducing monastic codes. I think they're called guidelines. Mm-hmm. And those guidelines have gotten longer since I was there 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like any complex community but finds it very useful to have guidelines on monastic codes. My guess is that over time, the more complex we get, the more we'll find useful to create our own. Yes?
Did you say or hint that maybe the Sravaka codes and the 10 skillful actions were not that dissimilar from the 10 Bodhisattva precepts and the monastic codes? They just have sort of...
Yes, I think that... the Vinaya, the 250 or 227 precepts of a monk, they can be, I think it's relatively, you could fairly call them monastic codes that are comparable to the monastic codes of Chan and Zen. They're not comparable to what we would want to call precepts. And so to make that comparison, which the Vision did, they considered themselves, those two to be the same category. The Bodhisattva precepts and the Sravaka 250 precepts, and therefore they could criticize them. But it's criticizing something that doesn't belong together. It's apples and oranges. And so they kind of pulled a fast one on us, one-upmanship that way. But actually, they're monastic codes, just like the Zen and Shingya are monastic codes. And if you want to look for what we went after as precepts in modern Soto Zen, you want to find a comparable thing in the early Buddhist tradition, you don't go to the Vinaya. But you go to these 10 skillful actions. Mm-hmm. Yep. I see Grace already. She's been trying for a while.
I think it's interesting to look at how the Ten Commandments are very according to political movements, because we haven't had as much experience with precepts evolving yet in this time. For example, love thy neighbor and so on. And the use of current politics to pervert some of the intention of early Christianity. The other thing I wanted to mention about the killing was in my last trip to Japan when I was on Mount Koya. Part of the folklore there
is if there's a gravesite that's cracked, granite, and granite doesn't crack, and it belonged to a general of Nobunaga who burned down Mount Hiei when the Tendai monks were so corrupt. And the general supported Nobunaga when he burned down Mount Hiei, and they killed every man, woman, and child on the mountain. But the general killed Nobunaga when he went to burn down Mount Koya, the Shingon headquarters. And so then he became a monk, and he was buried there in the cemetery, and people really pondered the question, it's alive for them, whether killing your general, your lord, the general killing his lord, seeing the gravestone crack meant that he had done the wrong thing or the right thing. So it's very much alive in the culture.
Great. That's nice to hear. Thank you. This
morning we were talking about the these proposed SCBA ethics standards, and we came upon the notion of moral relativism. So without going into that too much, I feel that you have to be careful of conflating the Shravaka precepts and the Shinki, in that their source of authority is different. That purportedly the source of authority for the Shravaka precepts are the Buddha's own rulings on ethical questions. So they have, unarguably ethical, enlightened basis. Whereas the Shingi, as we know, they're involved in some kind of, they are linked culturally to various kinds of evolution. The Shingi at Tassajara are not the same as the Ehe Shingi, but the Zenin Shingi. So to call them the same, because the precepts theoretically that Theravada monks live by now are the same lattice work of daily activity that at least they attempt to say they are, that you have lived 500 or 1,000 years ago. The precepts themselves have not evolved or changed, whereas the Shingi do evolve or change.
Yes, they haven't. That's a whole issue in Theravada Buddhism, is the fact that Ananda didn't ask the Buddha what he meant by the minor rules,
right,
that you could change. And also, so it's kind of conservative tradition that way. But also, there is in the Theravada Vinaya provisions that say that certain things don't have to be followed outside of India, because it's just too hard to, And so outside, so there is some recognition that it's something particular to India. The other thing that stands out if you read the Pali Vinaya code is how much of those codes were created not for moral or ethical reasons or for training reasons per se, but for public relations.
Yeah.
So that, and public relations has a lot to do about what was expected among the renunciant traditions of India at that time. So the renunciant tradition would kind of fit into the wider society and, the reputation would be upheld. So again, it has a lot to do with the local situation. So in that sense, they're comparable. So the monastic codes in China have to do with the local situation there. Perhaps less bound to the wider society than they were in India.
But they didn't become concretized in the way that the Vinaya.
Right, that's true. So they didn't get concretized as much because they can be changed. Yes, please.
Excuse me. Yes, I do have a voice. I wasn't sure for a moment. When I practiced in Japan, we had lots of little monastic regulations about things like how you line up to go out for takohatsu, how you wear your hat, how you hold your hands, how you conduct yourself in the city. And in the monastery also, how you sit, how you stand, how you walk. And I am a reader of the Vinaya and have found many of those things in the Vinaya, the English translations of the Vinaya, and also in the Nikayas.
So it's very clear that Dogen was very familiar with the Vinaya, with the four-part Vinaya, and he read them. He was very apparently fluent and understood them well, rehearsed them regularly, and so it was all part of that whole Vinaya movement. So it doesn't surprise me if you find some comparable things, because there's close familiarity. The Chan monasteries in China, they were very familiar with the Vinaya, they can practice them, they depend on the image of the state, they kind of depend on them. Yes, Tanya.
I'm interested in your bringing up the 10 skillful actions and talking about what are liberative criteria. So that somehow that fits for me in the rephrasing, retranslation of the alcohol precept or whatever, to go from not selling alcohol to don't encourage intoxication in yourself or other. With how we'll state that seems to me to be something that would be appropriate for us as a shift in terms of it's not just alcohol, it's drugs and all kinds of other intoxicants.
Yeah.
So to what extent would you support kind of unpacking or elaboration of what is skillful and in terms of thinking of precepts as part of a living tradition, how does that work for us?
Well, I don't want to say too much, but that was the point I was trying to make. I think that the notion of skillfulness warrants a second look, a deeper look, and to see how it might be interesting for us as we try to understand how to live with these precepts. And I think that you might be able to say that the precept of not selling alcohol has a little bit more to do with the impact it has on other people, and not so much on yourself, maybe karmically perhaps. The precept of not deluding yourself, not getting intoxicated yourself, has brought it back to some emphasis, brought it back to the effect it has on ourselves, and so how it affects our engagement with the path and our practice. So in that sense, it's a kind of going back to the spirit or kind of the approaches or early tradition. Is that kind of what you have in mind?
Yeah, but also just the whole notion of intoxication as opposed to awareness.
Yes.
Self or
other. Yeah. If awareness is connected to Buddha nature,
and to liberation.
Deliberation.
No.
Yes, please.
Two anecdotal stories that might support the idea of the 10 skillful actions being skillful in terms of cultivating the mind and moving towards enlightenment. We were talking recently with Ajahn Sumedho, and I think one of our students asked him about demons and obstacles on the path. And he said, well, the thing to do if you are possessed by demons or obstacles on the path, demons in the mind, being aspects of the mind that are preventing you from moving forward in training, the thing to do is to take the precepts. Now, I guess he would have meant the 5 precepts. We didn't specify, but he's a Theravadin, so I think that's what he meant. And he was very clear about that. That's what must be done, and then that will help modify that difficulty. Mm-hmm. So it's skillful to take the precepts, in other words. Then the other story is in talking with Ajahn Amaro about the clarity that Ajahn Chah had as an extraordinary teacher. We were asking about, well, you can't always have someone with that clarity of hearing in a monastery, let's say in Thailand. And he said, no, of course not. People of greater or lesser clarity appear all the time. But maintaining the vinaya, the mass of monks or nuns, maintaining the vinaya over the years creates a cradle in which someone of great clarity can appear. So you're not just maintaining the vinaya for your own benefit in terms of your own path to enlightenment, but also so that another person of greater clarity can arise.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Can I ask a political correct question?
Politically correct question.
I noticed that you're comfortably saying Hinayana and Mahayana, and
for a lot
of years we weren't allowed to say Hinayana.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not comfortable using it. I was using it comfortably in the voice of the Mahayana.
Thank you. Okay.
So, kind of, this is the rhetoric of Mahayana. I hope all of you understand that the literal meaning of Hinayana means the lousy vehicle. It's not the small vehicle; it's the crummy vehicle. So it's in a much more pejorative term than small vehicle might imply. And so, it's not really politically correct to use it anymore. So, people use the most common scholarly is they call it Nikaya Buddhism. Nikaya, because the Nikaya means group. so there's different Nikayas, different sects. The earliest is 18 sects, 18 Nikayas for the Mahayana. Also, in terms of development of Mahayana, in order to understanding the shift into what became the Bodhisattva precepts and some of this, you have to go back to Asanga as well. It was very important for this. And Asanga's chapter on ethics and a variety of places. And it seems that Asanga had a huge deal to do with the creation of the Mahayana as a self-identity, self as a tradition, which had its own self-identity, you know, kind of separate from everybody else. And that's fairly late for what most people think of as the origins of Mahayana. Asanga was in the 4th century. And he was the one who really started emphasizing some kind of Bodhisattva precepts and ethics that was different than the earlier ones. He was the one who started to gather together all the different Bodhisattva sutras, all the sutras that focus on the Bodhisattva path, and lumped them all together into a collection of Mahayana sutras. And before that, before Asanga, as far as we can tell, the evidence we have is that the Mahayana, the people engaged in the Bodhisattva path were not considering themselves as a distinct and separate group from what was going on in the other schools of Buddhism or pan-Buddhism. And it was, you know, it was like just different. You go to college and you can do different majors. You can go to monasteries in early centers of this era in India, and you could major in Shravaka, Bodhisattva, and for the most part, they lived harmoniously together and supported each other, and there wasn't a big kind of separation. But as time developed, with Asanga was when, first historically, as far as I could tell, the first person who started to create kind of a straw man of the Hinayana, the separation, pulling them apart. There might be some other origins for that, but he had a huge role.
Are you saying that he not only collected the Mahayana, but he dissed the Nikaya or however you want
to say it? I don't know enough about the dissing part, but he was the one who started to create a very strong separate identity. Like, we have the people who do this. We're a separate group. We have the Bodhisattva precepts.
There is an implicit.
I think so.
I mean, there's an implicit,
separation, yes. Okay, yes, a kind of separation, pulling apart of what was used to be much more integrated.
So some of those dissing phrases about lesser vehicle were already in the sutras that he was collecting?
Not as much as you would think, not before him. It also depends a little bit on, the historical dating of some of these sutras. I mean, one of the more dramatic ones is the Lotus Sutra, which is a very strange sutra it's a kind of Bible of East Asian Buddhism. It's very important there. But in the context of Indian and Tibetan Buddhism, it really stands out as an anomaly. And so it has something in there. So, but exactly, you can see in the Lotus Sutra, it's very clear that it's a layer of text. It wasn't just written all at once, but it kept being added to it. So different layers, historical layers. And as historical layers of Lotus Sutra went on, the younger parts were the ones that create a stronger and stronger sense of the Mahayana identity, or the Bodhisattva identity, Bodhisattva community as opposed to others. But the earliest layers of the Lotus Sutra doesn't have that strong sense of self-identity. So is there anyone else here in the back?
Yeah, I think though that you also find some language in earlier sutras that were written prior to Asanga, like the Malakuti, that also the temples and actions that we had from the Theravada tradition may not be directly comparable to the temples and actions that we have as the basis of the great precepts. I think that. And if you look at these earlier Mahayana sutras, like the Malakriti and the Alakam Sutra that we have here, that's more comfortable. I don't know if anybody here knows the answer, that if some of the earlier traditions, like, say, Sarvastivada, that there might not be a more comparable set of temples and actions.
Yes, it could well be. See, at some point they inserted the one about alcohol, right? And that happened in Nikaya Buddhism as well as the early Bodhisattva tradition. They're all doing it. And so it's true that the lineage might not have been through the Pali Canon directly. You know, we don't know exactly where they picked it up. I think it's fair to say the chances that it came through the Theravada and Pali tradition is small. It's more likely that it came like Svastavadin than Vilasavastavadin or the Tundraguptakas or someone like that. But, you know, it's basically coming from the same original source because they pretty much have the same thing. And I think that some of the early Agamas texts will have these, the same as the Pali. But that as a commentary to stuff that had been written added later on, they started kind of shifting and changing. But like the collection of wisdom 8,000 line is one of those texts that has 11. It has these 10, and then it has the alcoholic added to it. So that's considered often close to our tradition, the collection of wisdom tradition. So exactly how this went, I think it was such a big, it's like a, so many people are doing it that you can't really find a straight historical line back. And the question about the Vimalakirti Sutra is an interesting one, because first is when was it written, and you know, the version we have now needs to come out. It's relatively early in its earliest version, it was added to over time. But this is an interpretation, but my interpretation of the Vimalakirti Sutra is that it's the most polished piece of literature that was produced in the age of Buddhism. So other people have different opinions. It was a self-consciously produced piece. And my guess, it was produced by a playwright writing for the royal courts in northwest Afghanistan, Pakistan area, for the royal courts. And it was originally meant to be a complete satire of everything Buddhist. and it just happens in that complete satire that included the Shravakas and the criticized them, but they criticize everyone. And Vimalakirti gets the upper hand of everybody. And then over time, the Buddhists forgot that it was a satire.
Actually, I also found it helpful, speaking of the precept about speaking of the faults of others, the first formulation, I was thinking that it's that original formulation of the skillful practices is more descriptive, because for me, or descriptive of enlightened behavior or something, because it's always been hard for me to explain how critical the Buddha is of others in the early scriptures, because he frequently blames people and criticizes people. But so under that page right there, you talk about not criticizing, I think, lay and bodhisattva practitioners. Was that the original formulation?
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of what the Buddha was doing. He's criticizing lots of people, but for helpful reasons. And now it's become not to point out the faults of others, which is a very difficult line to walk in our practice.
I hope my teachers point out my faults.
Me too, yes. Exactly.
I don't hold them. I wouldn't criticize. How could you tell me that? You're breaking the precept. Yes, go on. No, I'm sorry. You're calling your name.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. One of the things that interests me about this is, in relationship to Dogen, is his interpretation of the Fox Sutra, the Fox poem. And my understanding is that in the earliest fastball in Shogenso, he talks about it in a way that's more about the famous line, "You are not obstructed by karma," which very much speaks to his idea of dharma position and all of those, this whole kind of view that Dogen presents of practice. And then I guess the later one, he quantifies it more and starts to talk about it more in those kind of rules that we associate with precepts. And now I guess there's a whole controversy about this, where people think that the later one, if it was the earlier one, Dogen didn't know what he was talking about, the later one, or getting it back from. And so, I mean, if somebody could speak to this, I'd appreciate it, because I think it's really interesting about Dogen's understanding of these precepts in relationship to his interpretation and his basic kind of worldview of practice, and that it isn't that kind of specific application of these admonitions, if you will, as a way to cultivate skillful means.
So, yeah, so one of the vexing challenges of Dogen studies is to account for the differences in his writings over time. And of course, it requires interpretation, but then as soon as you have interpretation, you have different people interpreting differently. And you know, some people say interpreting is no difference, it all harmonizes all together. And some people say, no, in fact, what he was teaching early on, even like things like the Bhukkha Zangi, should be kind of, you know, his thoughts, his understanding evolved and changed to the end of his life. And he had a very different teaching near the end. And then one of the differences was near the end, he became critical of the Tendai teaching of original enlightenment, inherent enlightenment. As he got older, his later writings, he emphasized much more karma in the way that you can understand karma in the early Buddhist tradition. It's how to find our way through these questions. I don't have a clue. I wish I knew. But the Taiken probably will help us.
Yeah, all I can do is express an opinion, which is that the changes in Dogen over time, Stephen and I's last work goes into this in detail, the changes in Dogen's teaching over time are much more a matter of genre and emphasis than changing his viewpoint, with the one exception of what Tenshi brought up, which is that he really does take precepts and the effects of action and karma much more seriously, and he changes his interpretation of the clock's going. And that's the one that's very clearly a difference in the viewpoint. The rest, one could say, is a matter of who he was talking to and his emphasis rather than some change in his perspective.
Thank you. Yes, please.
That brings up a point I wanted to bring. Stephen spoke at the Atlanta conference on Dogen, and at that point of Dogen's decline. And I wanted to bring you remember better than I do. But isn't there a scholarly problem in sort of interpreting from the written record how impactful these teachings were at the time in the tradition, especially that relies on face-to-face practice? For instance, he said that after Heiji was established, Dogen was not as productive because there's no written record. But in Zen, the written record is, you know, secondary, you might say, to the face-to-face practice. So is it like you can speak to that scholarly issue since you're one practitioner?
In terms of talking about Dogen, I'm not sure what to say. I have the impression that Dogen shifted over time about his appreciation or valuation of the special transmission outside the scriptures. So it kind of got that idea kind of fell away more later in life than the tools earlier. So about the special transmission, I don't know. He put a lot of time into writing. But I talked to a good folk this week about this whole issue of precepts. And he, over and over again to me, wanted to say that there's so much we don't have. And we have to be very careful not to argue based on lack of evidence. And so, for example, he was saying that this whole idea that that the Jukai, the 16 precepts, is what was the basis of Dogen's ordination and how he was ordaining people. We're arguing from lack of evidence. It seems very odd. Jukai thought it was very odd that he would not have a more fully developed ordination procedures for his monks. And the fact that we don't have a writing that explains that doesn't mean that he didn't have it. And so, I find it very vexing, this whole kind of study.
That's the point I wanted to make, is that if you take our written record today and compare it to how we actually practice, you find a very minimal relationship there. So if somebody's looking at these 1,000 years from now and saying, well, this is what they did.
So it's a very good point, but then it begs asking you, why is that important?
I'm not sure.
Ah.
But it's curious to me the difficulty the scholar has.
Okay. Yes, please.
I think it's important to remember also that all the writings we have of Dogen, perhaps the occasional exceptions on the late discovery in the House of Kyoto, basically passed through a single editorial sometime in the 18th century. So it's not clear how much has been compressed out of the tradition and lost.
Dogen scholarship is frustrating, though I find it very inspiring to read it. Yes, please.
Well, I'd like to kind of get back to the two sides of the left and the right. The left and the right in Buddhist practice. Like, the conservative and the liberal.
Now, could you stand up?
The conservative side and the liberal side. And it seems like the conservative side rules, lots of rules. And the liberal side is more like intuition. Zen practice has a lot of intuition. And rule practice, I don't know about. I mean, you know, you deny it. 275 rules, if there's room for intuition. Because it seems like everything is managed. So there's some people who gravitate toward managed life, and some people who gravitate toward intuition and responding in the moment. And it seems like Buddhist practice is more in the middle, actually. How you take both of the sides and find your way, given that you have rules and you also have freedom. And between those two is where you want your actual practice of or virtues takes place.
Yeah. But back to the 10 skillful actions. It's interesting that, at least in the Pali tradition, that they're not limited to either monastic or lay. So they just like the Bodhisattva precepts as they developed, stood outside the bounds and limitations of one category or the other, as both. And also, to some degree, the skillful actions are principles around skillfulness, which doesn't speak to a hard and fast rule approach. But it doesn't exactly fall into an intuition approach either. I think it's a third option. I don't know if it's the middle way, synthesis or something. I think so. So, did you have your hand up? Yeah. Please.
Just to follow a little bit up on Mel's sort of distinction, it seems from our lineage, the Soto lineage in America, that with the Bodhisattva precepts, that allows a little more sort of Zen freedom, that we tend to come up with more rules because there's been a little trouble in the home. So I don't know where those two fit together, but it does seem like we need a little bit of both. And that we didn't have quite enough rules for a while.
Yes, it could be. It could also be that we haven't done a well good enough job at pointing back to the practice principles behind the rules. And so, for example, the idea of skillfulness, if you want to adopt it. But if people really understand what that's about, then perhaps there's less need for rules.
Maybe one more, because we're off the book.
Sure.
I just want to mention I have a cartoon that I've saved for years that I sometimes send out to people. And it shows Moses coming down the mountain with the Ten Commandments. And he says, for now we have these Ten Commandments. We'll work out the ethics later.
So in other words, we work out the interpretation of them later.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what we want to do with this epic statement. There's certainly key principles we need to establish.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.